Mr. Stevens, reel one. Whereabouts were you born, please?
In London, 1916.
But I think your father was not British.
No, he was Serbian.
Was your mother British?
English, yes.
How would your father come to Britain?
Well, he was a great traveller. He went all around Europe and all around the world several times, apparently, according to the family history. And his father was a great friend of the Serbian minister in London, Čeda Mijatović. And when he decided to come to England, his father gave him a letter of introduction to Čeda Mijatović, who introduced him to my mother's family, Stevens, and he lived with them for a while and married my mother. His name was Svetislav Simic. Now, Simic in Yugoslavia is almost like Smith in England. And if you're wondering why I'm called Stevens, I have to explain that after the war, when I was demobbed, still in uniform, I used to go and meet my wife at Lloyd's Bank, where she worked in Cox and King's. And the little girls around, he says, "Oh, Captain Simic, don't you speak marvellous English for a foreigner?" And I would say, "For God's sake, I'm born and bred in London. English is my mother tongue. I speak pretty fluent Serbo-Croatian, which I learned at 16 when I went out there. But it's not my mother tongue." And then my wife said to me, "Well, why don't you do what your mother did when she couldn't get a job as Mrs. Simic, as a widow, because my father died when I was very young?" And the family suggested she resume her maiden name, which she did. And she asked me why I didn't when I came back from Yugoslavia after 5 years out there. And I said, "No, why the hell should I change my name? I'm not ashamed of it." But anyway, listening to my wife, I decided, when I got demobbed in 1946, perhaps I ought to. So I raked out an old deed poll form, yellow by this time, which I'd had before the war and wouldn't use. I took it down to the London Gazette. The fellow there said, "Look, Captain Simic, you don't want to waste 5 guineas. Go along to the Commissioner of Oaths, and for 10 bob, he'll make your name whatever you want it to be." I did this. I did not drop my name of Simic. I kept it as a middle name. In fact, in business, I used to be called Alexander Simic Stevens until my colleagues got fed up with such a long name and said, "Oh, for God's sake, let's call it Steve." Then it was Alex S. Stevens, and then it was A.S. Stevens. Rather unfortunate initials, you know, the golden S. of upper layers type of thing. I sometimes forget that I was ever called Simic. The British Yugoslav Society, of which I'm a member, they still do call me Simic Stevens, and they do hyphenate it, which I've never done.
What did your father do for a living?
He was everything. He was, by profession, an electrical engineer, according to the birth certificate, my birth certificate. But he was an entrepreneur. He did everything under the sun, apparently.
And where did you go to school?
I went to the Oratory, a grammar school. It used not to be called a grammar school for some technical reason for the Roman Catholics at that time. Because, as I said, I was made a Roman Catholic by going to a convent when my mother was a widow and had to go and park me somewhere, and my sister, my twin sister.
So you went to school in Brompton?
Well, actually, in Stuart's Grove, off the Fulham Road in South Kensington. It was called the Oratory Central then, in those days, but it was classified as a grammar school. Yes. I had passed for an examination for a Cardinal Vaughan school, but my mother couldn't afford the extra fees that she would have had to pay despite a grant. I was very pleased. It meant I would have ended up as a priest, which I, in later life, had no wish to be.
But was your father Orthodox in religion?
Well, he was Serb Orthodox, but I don't think he practiced it very often, although I was baptised, and my sister were baptised in a Serb Orthodox church in London.
How old were you when you left school?
I was 15 and a half. I thought I'd got a job on this telegraph as a messenger boy, hoping to be eventually a journalist, which was my ambition. But when I'd actually left school and went up there, they told me the job had been given to somebody else. So rather than go back to school and admit failure, you know, I'm all proper if you wish, I did all sorts of odd jobs until my father's sister, who was a war nurse in the First War, a very much decorated woman, came to London and said, "Wouldn't I like to visit my father's people?" As I say, he died when I was six, although we never saw him after we were 2 and a half. And I said, "Yes, I'd love to go." She was going back from Nice and Vichy, where she had a business as a masseuse, following on the wartime nursing experience. She agreed to take me the following year in 32. I joined her in Vichy, spent a month with her there while she settled her affairs, went on to Nice, where I had another glorious 5 weeks, eventually landed in Belgrade in a wet, miserable day in 1932, in October or November, I think it was. And I was homesick for the first time. I missed my mother, my family, everything. But I got used to the Serbian family. They all crowded around me, made a fuss of me. Of course, I spoke no Serbian. All I spoke was English and schoolboy French. Now, the old aunt went back after a month, left me with them. I decided to stay on. And I met a fellow called Atherton, who was the Sunday Dispatch and Daily Mail correspondent, and he also published a paper called the South Stuff Herald. He sent a story about me to the News, Evening News, as a, you know, Londoner going back to his father's people, and suggested if I wanted to be a journalist, with my mother's permission, he would take me on. And I wrote to her, and she agreed.
What was his journal?
The South Slough Herald was the local English newspaper that he published for tourism and business. We had to be careful about politics, of course. We were under the Press Bureau and very often got censored anyway. He later issued another paper called the Balkan Herald, which applied to all the Balkan countries, all of whom, of course, gave us subsidies, without which, in the advertising, we could never have subsisted. But I spent 5 years with him, became his... I learned Serbo-Croatian for a start. My grandfather got me a Serbian tutor, said it couldn't be that his grandson, shameful that his grandson couldn't speak Serbian. I learned pretty efficient Serbo-Croatian then, grammatical, because every time I tried to say something, if I was wrong, he would interrupt me. Ni tako sinko, he'd say to me, not like that, son. And I learned it properly. Anyway, I joined Atherton, worked with him, then I became the Evening Standard and Star correspondent on a freelance basis. After 5 years, during which time I travelled all over Yugoslavia on a first-class journalist ticket, I got homesick, just thought it was time I had to go up Fleet Street, and went back to London, and for a while worked on the Sunday Dispatch. I didn't last there very long because I had very anti-Hitler views, and the Sunday Dispatch at that time was very pro-Axis powers, and I left them and became a freelance. Didn't do very well because war was in the offing, and then war broke out, and that sort of settled all my problems.
Had you become politically organised before the war?
In a rather amorphous way. I always had this thing about injustice throughout the world. My mother was a liberal, a strong liberal, and it was a very strong liberal family, in fact. And she imparted her basic ideas to me, and I sort of improved upon them. I read, I discussed, I talked. In fact, when I went out to Yugoslavia, I was a Roman Catholic still, a very fanatical Roman Catholic. Talking to Atherton and reading, I one day decided that it was not for me anymore. I didn't make sense any longer. All my beliefs went by the board. I got off my knees one evening in prayers, and I never went down since, ever again, except as a mark of respect to friends and relations when I went to churches to partake in weddings and funerals and baptisms. I became an agnostic, quite frankly, and I've been so ever since.
Did you come across any political parties either in Yugoslavia or in England before the war?
Well, in Yugoslavia, I had a great friend who was a member of the Communist Party, Milivoj Milinkovic. I used to call him the Mandarin because he looked like one. He taught me an awful lot. Great friend of mine. I believe he was shot by the Germans in the war as a communist because they caught him in Belgrade. So I heard. Would you like me to say anything further about that?
Yes, please.
As I say, I was never at that time a member of any party. I just had, how can I put it, rather vague left-wing views, radical views. I thought there was too much injustice throughout the world, not only in England, but everywhere. And I wanted to see matters improved, if you like, in a youthful sort of way, optimistic way, in fact.
So... this communist you mentioned lived in Belgrade.
Oh, yes, yes. He was a freelance journalist, sometimes in funds, mostly without. I also met Vladimir Dadia, who figured in post-war politics. He was a journalist on the Politica, the foremost Yugoslav newspaper, still running today. And I used to meet him outside the Politica offices, and he would give me stories to cable to the Evening Standard and the Star, you know, about midnight. Then we go and have a drink together. Now, I met Vladimir again during the war when he came to Slovenia, when I was with the GHQ, the partisan GHQ in Slovenia. Came there having been wounded. He came on some mission, and we renewed contact very, very briefly. But I never saw him again after that, unfortunately.
Had you met any British communists in Britain before the war?
No, no. Well, I say no. I met one or two, but it didn't mean much to me.
What were you doing when war was declared?
I was freelancing as a journalist.
What was your reaction to the war declaration?
I was a bit cynical. I thought it was just another another attempt by reactionary powers to to defeat Russia, quite frankly. After all, we had the chance to join in Litvinov's peace pact, which we declined. And I think had we done so, there'd never have been a Second World War. That's my opinion, anyway.
So that was the kind of attitude that the British Communist Party, in fact, came to adopt in the early part of the war.
I had no contact with them, but I thought that was the... By that time, although I joined the Young Communist League for a while to edit their wallpaper, I fell out with them over difference of opinion over certain things, and I just became a sort of a very amorphous radical. I don't know how else to describe myself.
How had you come across the Young Communist League?
Oh, through a neighbour.
In London,
yes. A Welsh fellow, actually, but I've long since lost contact with him. I've no idea where he is now.
And do you remember the names of any people in the YCL that you...
I don't. I honestly don't. I've got no recollection at all. So I was only in it for about 3 months before I decided to opt out.
Which year was that, do you think?
Oh...
How old would you have been?
When I came back from Yugoslavia in 37, this must have been when I was about... I was on the dispatch in 38. I didn't last long there, as I said. This was about 39, I suppose. Just before the outbreak of war, really.
Yeah. How had you reacted to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in August 1939?
Well, I was upset, but I thought I knew the reason why. If the West was so determined... To show perpetual hostility to Soviet Russia, I suppose one couldn't blame them for seeking allies in another direction. Regrettable though it was.
Where were you when the bombing started in Britain in the summer of 1940?
I was in the army by then. You see, I have to explain that when I read the reports of what Hitler was doing to the Jews and the Slavs and the Gypsies, I just felt this man has got to be stopped, you know. So I went up to volunteer for the Navy as the next Sea Scout. That was the life I would have wanted. But I was told that they wouldn't accept me because of my Anglo-Serbian blood and the fact that I spoke Serbo-Croatian. And they seemed convinced that eventually the Yugoslavia would be embroiled in the war. So they said I wasn't a volunteer for anything. They'd put me on what they called the professional register, which means they would call me when they wanted me. I was to go home, notify them any change of address and stay put.
When was this that you'd approached the forces?
Early 1940. Then came April 1943 and the 23-year-old call-up, so that was myself, and all of a sudden I had a movement order to join the AMPC. Now, I hadn't got a clue what AMPC meant. Even my old uncle, who was an ex-army man, thought it must be Auxiliary Military Police Corps. Well, that was a joke, seeing I was only 5'6½". It wasn't until I got to captain... in April 1940, when I discovered it was the Auxiliary Military Pioneer Corps. Apparently I'd been put in there because I was dubbed binocular vision. I've got a weak right eye, 6'18". This didn't stop me being a good marksman, as it happens later on. Anyway, I was in the Pioneer Corps. I became a war lieutenant corporal. And there was an ACI came round very early in 1940 asking for people who spoke any of the following languages, including Serbo-Croatian, to fill a questionnaire and return it. Well, I did this and forgot all about it because I heard nothing further. Until I'd already transferred to the Intelligence Corps, at least for training, in Winchester.
When was that?
1942, when I was called up to the War Office to see a Colonel Bailey, who asked me, in view of my Anglo-Serbian parentage and origin, whether I would care to volunteer to drop in, to parachute into this chap Mihailovic, about whom we'd been reading in the press, because at that time we heard nothing about partisans, and I very willingly agreed. I thought to do something useful. So instead of going back to Intelligence Corps, I was taken into various groups, where I later met some Canadian Croats and a couple of American Yugoslavs who'd also volunteered to join what turned out to be SOE, although I was told it was called MO4. That was just a branch of the SOE. So we did various training up and down England, commando courses, parachute training, cipher, WT operator, etc., etc., usage of captured weapons for all emergencies, and eventually in October 1942, having done my parachute training at Ringways, I was on the Themistocles en route for West Africa.
Can you tell me a bit more in detail about the training that you had, where it took...
It was paramilitary training in general, explosives, handling all weapons. You name it, we did it. Unarmed combat, silent killing.
Do you remember the places that you went to?
There was a place in called Inchmere in near Southampton, I think, if I remember rightly. And also I did two commander courses up in Scotland, one at Arisaig, on a requisitioned estate, an enormous place, and the later one at Fort William, where I met Bill Deakin, Captain Deakin as then was, and I was by then an acting sergeant, also sergeant corporal. Because in our special lot, there was no room for further promotions. Anyway, I had no
idea. What did you think of the quality of the training that you received?
I thought it was pretty good. There were certain things I could have criticised, but on the whole, I was well satisfied with it.
What could you have criticised?
At this stage, I can't remember. There were minor things of admin and so on. I don't think we were told enough. We were all sworn to strict secrecy, so I had no idea that these Canadian Croats were going to were intended to go to Tito. I assumed I was going to Mihailovic, because we had never heard anything about the partisans in those days. Anyway, it wasn't until I was eventually on the boat on the Themistocles going to West Africa that one of them, George Dietlich, a 50-year-old miner as wide as he was broad, said to me, "You know, of course, Alexander, where you're going, don't you?" I said, "Yes, proudly, to Mihailovic, the Serb hero." And he said to me, "What, that bastard?" I was amazed. I couldn't understand what he was talking about. He said, "Look, read this." And he showed me some cuttings from an International Brigade's journal published after the war in four languages, where there was a complete expose, it claimed, of Mihailovic cooperating with the Germans and the Italians, that he was controlling large areas of Serbia with German arms and money and food and equipment, and likewise with the Italians. I just could not believe it. And they couldn't believe that I didn't know about Mihailovic. Anyway, when we finally got to Cairo...
Which date is this that you got to Cairo?
Well, I just arrived there on Christmas Day 1942, having had malaria, incurred it on the way and had to go into the Scottish Hospital for 5 weeks of malaria treatment. And they gave me some experimental treatment which has prevented me ever having another attack. Fantastic treatment. I was pumped 3 weeks solid with all sorts of injections and various anti-malarial tablets, and they proved right. I've never had an attack since, although I've been to reunions of the Special Forces Club where I've met old colleagues who were absolutely shaking with it, with recurrent malaria. I've never had it. In fact, I was able to give blood for quite a while until I was 65 and they wouldn't take blood anymore from me.
So, you arrived at Cairo in what kind of state of mind after your contact with the Canadians?
Well, as soon as I got out of the hospital, I was very perplexed and very worried because I had no intention of joining a collaborator, no matter what. So, when I got finally out of hospital and joined the special crowd in Sir Lochiel Anton's old house along the Mina Road, where, the Yugoslav section, I asked James Klugman, who was then Lieutenant Klugman, was it true? And he said, "Yes, keep your hair on. We want you to go to this chap called Tito."
Were you more or less shouting at him?
No, I wasn't shouting. I just said, firmly, with all due respect, I said, "If it is true, then I am not going to go into Mihailovic. I volunteered in, I'll volunteer out." And that's when he said, "Keep your hair on. We want you to go to this chap called Tito." So I said, "Well, these fellas keep talking about Tito. Who the devil's Tito?" I'd never heard of Tito or the partisans until they'd mentioned it. Anyway, I did further training for nearly another year, actually, and it wasn't until, until April 1940, 20th, 21st, I can't remember exactly, when I and two communists, Canadian Croats they were, older men than myself, Pavle Pavlic was, I should think, late 40s, and he was the theoretical communist of the two. The other had been wounded, having fought in the International Brigade in Spain, and he was older than I was about 26 at the time. And eventually we took off from Derna, to cut a long story short, in civilian clothes, almost a comic opera outfit. We had riding breeches specially made, riding boots, We had a check shirt, underwear with the labels all ripped out in case we were captured so we wouldn't show where we were coming from. I thought that was a bit of a joke, but still. We had a flat cap and a leather coat. And, of course, we had Schmeissers and Beretta pistols, and I had the two WT sets and a change of crystals for change of wavelength. And, of course, I had the code book because I was the operator of the outfit. I had considered that as the natural-born Briton, I should be the leader of the outfit. But Basil Davidson, who was our section major, said, no, Alex, he said, it's obviously sensible to have two communists and two Croats who you're going to drop into their area so that they will be more acceptable than you may be. And he proved right, of course, as I will explain later.
Just before we go off into Yugoslavia, can you tell me more about the impression that the personnel at SOE headquarters in Cairo made on you, like James Klugman, Basil Davidson, Keeble, and
Well, I found them all pretty efficient people. Now, I know books have been written where they've been slanged, they've been criticised by people with views equally as bastards, I suppose mine are. I found them a very acceptable lot.
Did James Klugman say he was a communist to you?
No, he didn't, but it was fairly obvious to me. It wasn't until later on, when really we got back to London, that he invited me and we discussed joining the Communist Party, which I rejected for reasons I think I've already explained, that I don't like regimentation, I don't like one-party rule, etc., etc. Although I was not hostile to their main aims, I must stress that. I thought they were going to do it. They'd done a good job in rescuing Tsarist Russia from the Tsar and the Okhpur, etc., etc., serfdom. I had a lot of sympathy for them, but I didn't want to become a member.
Did you see much of Keeble?
No, thereby hangs the tale. It was said to me that although I was a War Studies Infantry Corporal Acting Sergeant, really I should be commissioned before going in on this task. Our job was to find the partisans, to make the initial contact. And I'm very proud that I am the first natural-born Briton to be dropped in officially to contact the partisans. I know that previous officers, Hudson, Atherton, my ex-editor, they'd been in, but their brief was to go to Mihailovic. The fact that they accidentally passed through partisan lines and had conversation with them and reported the facts to HQ, GHQ, didn't alter the fact that their mission was to Mihailovic. So I still claim that honour. I'm very proud of it, and I must say, I've got my share of Amour Propre, like everybody else, of course. Anyway, how do you want me to get...
I'd ask you if you saw much of Keeble.
No, I never saw Keeble except at a distance, but he was supposed to interview me for a commission. And the day I was due to see him, he fell ill with the flu, and I was seen, he said, by Colonel Tamplin, I forget the exact name. Now, he was a chap who was married to a white Russian, and as I later transpired, was violently anti-partisan, anti-communist. In fact, his first words to me were, "What do you want to go to these bloody Reds for, Sergeant?" And I said, "Well, I think they're doing a good job, sir. Yeah, that's all." Not because I'm half Yugoslav, although I suppose that's the reason why I've been chosen. I just think they're doing a damn good... If they're fighting our common enemy, that's good enough for me.
Did he then drop the...
He said, Well, I heard no more. And I knew that I wasn't going to get any help in that quarter. So I went in as War Sergeant Corporal Acting Sergeant and was later made Acting Star Sergeant by Bill Jones when he dropped in, the Canadian Major who took over the mission, at the Croatian GHQ, that is. Because do you want to revert to when we dropped in?
Right.
Well, we went over in a Liberator.
Which date is this?
It was either the night of the 19th, 20th or 20th, 21st. I can't remember exactly, but records will have it.
And the month and the...
April 1943. So I was even in before Michael Lees went to Mihailovic, because he went in June, I believe. So the article said this morning. I'm very proud of that, I'll be honest with you. Now, I found these two Canadian communists, Canadian communists, very excellent people. Not because of similarity ideas, but they were very charming, quietly spoken people. They never tried to ram anything down my throat. They admitted to me quite frankly that they and all the rest of the Canadian Croats, and maybe some of the Americans as well, American Croats, had volunteered purely to get back to their homeland, because no other way they could have got back to join the struggle, as they put it. And which is what they all did eventually. They all joined the partisans. Peter and Paul, the other member, of my group, my mission, which is called Fungus, the original mission, may I say. He was Peter Adelitz was the other chap. And I, as I say, I had excellent relations with them. They were later, they joined the Partisans, of course, with GHQ's permission, and they became lieutenant colonels and did, I understand, excellent work for their people. They both died since.
Now, can you describe in detail what the flight was like?
Oh, the flight was uneventful, except that when we got over the, we had chosen a place called Shishanyapolye, a very large area, about 18 kilometres wide, where we thought we had a good chance of getting away and burying our gear and contacting local people. But as it happened, there was a very strong mist, and the pilot cruised around and said, look, I can't see anywhere to drop you. You've either got to drop now or we go back to Downer. And we said, no way are we going back to Downer. So we dropped.
Why didn't you want to go back to Downer?
Oh, after all the delay and the waiting. Oh, no, it was an unbearable thought. So Peter Pavlovich dropped first. And in going, he kicked me so that I fell on one side and I had to be released from the flap, you know, the hatchway by the dispatching sergeant. I dropped. And I was kicked on the head by Peter, who came after me very quickly, as needs be. He and I dropped very closely together, without any trouble, from about 800 feet. And we looked around for Paul Pavlich, who had disappeared. Because he dropped about a kilometre or so ahead of us, obviously, because of the delay through me being caught up in the hatchway. We dropped, by the way, through the belly of the Liberator, not through the door. Well, Peter and I rode around very quietly until we heard dogs barking in a nearby village, and we couldn't tell whether it was friendly or enemy hold or what. But all of a sudden, we came across a very ragged peasant who said, oh, where have you been, brothers? We've been looking for you all night long. Apparently, Paul had made contact with them, with the partisans, and had a party out looking for us. Now, the people had seen the plane cruising, wondered whether it was a German or Italian plane, whether it was some subversive dropping in on them, as non provocateur, in other words, until Paul appeared and explained the mission. We were then taken to the headquarters of a local division where the commandant was very suspicious of us. In fact, I was told afterwards that he was thought he might have us shot. That's a fact, you know. Yeah.
Can you understand that attitude?
No, I can't understand it. You know, he was so suspicious of enemy activity, of as non provocateur. Anyway, he eventually believed our story, gave us food, and took us the next day. I'm cutting things short here, of course.
Please give as much detail as you can.
Well, while I was being interrogated by the commandant, because they had no military ranks in those days, in the early days, they were just commandant of a detachment, partisan detachment. He interrogated us. Obviously, he got on better with the other two because they were his own people, Canadian Croats. Or Croatians by origin from that area, whereas I was obviously a foreigner, even if I was called Simic and did speak some Serbo-Croatian. He interrogated me pretty strictly, but he gave us something to eat. I think we had cheese, sheep's cheese, and some milk, rough bread, and then we went to bed. Now, the next morning, we were taken off with a patrol to go to the Croatian GHQ, which was further up in the hills, in the mountains. And we went sometimes on foot, sometimes on captured horse, sometimes on captured lorry. But eventually, after 3 days, we came to a clearing where there were lights showing, a lot of activity, and I discovered I was...